Yeah, in the high schools.
Well, and this is just eighth grade, so it was, you know.
Okay.
I'm not sure our high schoolers would have beat your eighth graders.
Under order. My name is Pat Ward. I'm an administrative law judge pursuant to temporary appointment designated by the Office of Administrative Hearings at the request of the Public Service Commission to serve as the procedural hearing officer for this hearing. This is the hearing on the consolidated application of Otter Tail Power for an advanced determination of prudence regarding whether two projects, Astoria Natural Gas, PU 17-140, and Maricourt Wind, PU 17-141, are prudent. They also request a certificate of public convenience and necessity for that project in case number PU 17-143. The record will show it is a little past 8:30 a.m., October 6, 2017, and we're in the commission hearing room on the 12th floor of the state capitol in Bismarck, North Dakota, which is the time, date, and place set by the notice of filing and notice of consolidating hearings issued by the Public Service Commission on June 30th. On April 10th, 2017, Otter Tail filed its applications mentioned above. The notice of filing and notice of hearing for case number PU... The notice of filing and notice of hearing for case number PU-17-143 specified the issues to be considered and determined upon this hearing as follows. Whether public convenience and necessity require or will require the construction and operation of the public utility plan or system. Whether the applicant is fit, willing, and able to provide service. On October 2nd, the Commission and the ALJ were advised of a proposed settlement between PSC staff and Otter Tail Power. My understanding is that the parties now plan to use this hearing to prove up the settlement. Mr. Stephenson, would you please state your appearance for the record?
Yes, Your Honor. Kerry Stephenson on behalf of Otter Tail Power Company.
Thank you. Mr. Armstrong?
Mitch Armstrong, Special Assistant Attorney General on behalf of Advocacy Staff, and with me is Victor Shook with Advocacy Staff.
Thank you. Will Mr. Shook be asking questions today?
Okay.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
Lon and Jeffcoat-Sacco, counsel with the commission as advisory counsel.
And I'm just going to ask right now, I'll probably ask again a few times, is there anyone present other than witnesses for Otter Tail Power or the commission who plans to testify or comment today concerning this matter? If you do, raise your hand. Okay, not seeing anyone. We'll move forward to opening remarks by the commissioners. Chairman Chrisman.
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't have a lot of opening remarks except for to say, you know, it's, I guess, always nice to see hearings for settlements than disputed cases, I guess. It helps, I think, move things along in most cases. And not to prejudge the case, but so not so much on the merits of the case, but just the clarity of the information. I want to commend both our staff as well as Otter Tail. I feel like I don't maybe even have a whole lot of questions unless things come up in the testimony that I am not expecting. The information that we've received, I think, has provided a lot of clarity, so I appreciate that. It's nice to have that extra time to review it in advance.
Thank you. Commissioner Fedorchak.
Good morning, everybody. I'll keep my comments brief, too. Thanks for the good crowd. Make us feel like people really care about what we're talking about today, so that's always nice. I appreciate the settlement as well, and I think it's the applications were very thorough. The questions and the analysis by the advocacy staff was also top-notch, and so I look forward to, you know, a good discussion this morning, and I think the application is pretty clear, so I, too, don't have a whole lot of questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Crocius.
Well, good morning, everyone. It's a beautiful, crisp North Dakota morning, so it's that time of the year. But, no, I would echo the same thoughts as Commissioner Chrisman and Commissioner Fedorchak. It's pretty straightforward. It's pretty clear. And, of course, with the settlement in place, that certainly helps. But the one thing that continues to strike me is this is just a classic example, if you will, in terms of a plant retirement being replaced with a renewable resource in combination with the the gas plant in Astoria. So I've got some questions that I'll ask along those lines as we proceed. But with that, I really don't have any other comments, and we'll get rolling.
Okay. Council, do we have any stipulated exhibits we want to move today?
Yes, Your Honor, we do. Mr. Armstrong and I have stipulated for the record the exhibits that we have provided a copy of. They're organized sequentially for the Astoria docket, the Maricourt docket, and then the Maricourt CPCN docket. And they are numbered Otter Tail Exhibits 1 through 18. And they are the applications, public and trade secret, the direct testimony, public and trade secret of our witnesses. And those individuals are Bradley Tollerson, Brian Draxton, Randy Stenslin, and William Swanson. For Maricourt, the same are applications, public and trade secret, the public and trade secret direct testimonies of our witnesses in that matter, Bradley Tollerson, Brian Draxton, Randy Stenslin, and Harvey McMahon, and Exhibit Otter Tail 17 is a settlement agreement, and then Exhibit 18 for Otter Tail is the opening statement of Brad Tollerson. And for the PSC, direct testimonies of Mr. Heidel, public and trade secret, and an opening statement of advocacy staff Victor Schock. And I would ask that these be stipulated into the record.
Thank you, Mr. Stephenson. Mr. Armstrong.
Stipulate.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle.
It's fine with us.
Okay. So exhibits Otter Tail Power 1 through 18 and PSC 1 through 3 will be admitted into evidence. Any opening statements, Mr. Stephenson?
No, Your Honor. We'll leave that for our witness.
Mr. Armstrong?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
No, sir.
Okay. You can call your first witness.
Otter Tail Power calls Bradley Tollerson.
Morning, Mr. Tollerson.
Morning.
I'm required by law to advise you of the penalty for perjury in this state. Perjury is a false statement under oath of a material fact made by a person who knows or does not believe the statement to be true at the time it is made. Perjury is a Class C felony. A Class C felony is subject to a maximum penalty of 5 years imprisonment, a fine of $10,000, or both may be imposed. Having been advised of the penalty for perjury, please raise your right hand. Do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but this, but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Thank you. Mr. Stephenson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Tollerson, I've left a copy of your public testimony, and you should have a copy of your opening statement. Would you please read your opening statement into the record?
Absolutely. Well, good morning, commissioners and staff. My name is Brad Tollerson. I am employed by Otter Tail Power Company as the Vice President of Planning and Strategy. I filed direct testimony in this proceeding regarding the Astoria Natural Gas Project and the Maricourt Wind Project. I'm here today to support the settlement agreement between advocacy staff and Otter Tail granting prudence for these projects. Astoria is an approximately 250-megawatt simple-cycle unit planned for the intersection of the Northern Border Natural Gas Line and the newly constructed Big Stone to Brookings 345 kV transmission line. The Astoria plant will be built to serve a load following function and peak capacity needs. Otter Tail will develop and manage the construction of the Astoria project. Maricourt is a 150-megawatt wind generation facility located in Dickey and McIntosh counties of North Dakota. The Maricourt project is being developed by EDF Renewable Energy. Otter Tail has entered into contracts to purchase the development assets and retain EDF to construct the facility. The two-part plan conforms to the Commission's need plus least cost planning standards. The projects are needed due to forecasted load growth, expiring capacity purchase agreements, and the retirement of Hoot Lake Units 2 and 3, an approximately 60-year-old coal plant located near Fergus Falls, Minnesota. Astoria will fulfill the company's demonstrated capacity need and backstop our energy requirements using proven, dispatchable, simple cycle technology that maximizes unit flexibility while reducing the company's long-term exposure to the natural gas commodity price risk relative to combined cycle natural gas generation. Mericourt will help fulfill Otter Tail's demonstrated energy needs. The company's economic analysis of the Mericourt project indicates that it will save Otter Tail's customers approximately $112 million over its life. The low-cost energy provided by the Mericourt project will reduce Otter Tail's reliance on potentially volatile energy markets and provide a hedge against future fuel price fluctuations, including for natural gas. Otter Tail appreciates the work of advocacy staff and the thorough analysis done by Mr. Heidel. The settlement agreement recognizes that these projects are prudent, viewed separately, and uniquely advantageous when viewed as a two-part plan to meet our customers' electric needs. The settlement agreement is consistent with the recommendations of Mr. Heidel. It reasonably balances risk and responsibility along traditional rate-making principles. The company has taken reasonable steps to manage and mitigate risks associated with the projects and is fit, willing, and able to assume ownership and operate both projects. The company asks that the Commission approve the settlement agreement. This concludes my opening statement, and I look forward to answering any questions you may have.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Tollerson? Mr. Stephenson?
This witness is available for cross-examination, Your Honor.
Mr. Armstrong?
No questions.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No questions.
Commissioners, Commissioner Crotius.
Can you give me an idea when the production tax credits for the wind development are factored into this? After 10 years when those expire, what will the impact to ratepayers be? How do you calculate that? Because it, you know, it's a sharp drop, obviously. They just go away after 10 years.
Yep. So when we evaluate these projects, we recognize that the production tax credit has a finite length of 10 years, and that savings is in place for that period of time. Customers enjoy that in their rates immediately, provided rider recovery is the method of recovery. At the end of that period of time, those production tax credits no longer flow through to the customer, so it is true that the rates increase at that point. But I believe we have an exhibit that shows that even after that point, costs remain below what they would have been in our base case scenario. So we evaluate the projects on a levelized cost of energy basis across the entire life of the project, and that's how we show the overall savings. But there is it is true that rates are lower in the beginning, rise, and then continue forward.
You had touched on one of the questions that I have a little further down on the list, but and I'm probably putting this in a really simple fashion, but producing the power rather buying it through the MISO market is going to be less with this approach in terms of producing it on your own, so to speak. Is that just generally speaking because there are energy generating types out there that are simply not as efficient as this combination will be, the wind and gas combination?
Right. So the way the resource planning analysis works is that we get forecasts of future energy market prices, future natural gas prices. We compare a variety of different generating technologies using those assumptions for forward prices, run a variety of scenarios around, you know, higher natural gas prices, lower natural gas prices, higher market prices, lower market prices, and test all of those different alternatives against those scenarios. At the end of the day, when doing that analysis, we've demonstrated that the wind plus simple cycle natural gas solution is the lowest cost and most robust solution across all of those scenarios.
Do you have concerns? And this was in the pricing model just and some of the assumptions on what the price of natural gas will be over the long haul. And I know it becomes an unknown with any fuel source. But Do you foresee any instances where natural gas would spike and all of a sudden the least cost solution is no longer least cost?
I think the basic premise is that a lot of folks have forecasted where natural gas prices plan to go, but in reality we know that historically it's been a volatile commodity, and those prices can and will change with time. I think your more specific question about what's the scenario where natural gas prices might rise? You know, if there were a fracking moratorium or somehow the supply of natural gas were to drop significantly, in that scenario, I think it only strengthened, I'm sorry, the price of natural gas would rise significantly based on a reduction in supply. That only strengthens the case for a portfolio or the two-part plan that we're bringing forward, and that the price of the Maricourt wind generation is going to be fixed over the life of that project. We know what that cost is based on the capital projections. If natural gas prices rise significantly, our other alternative of having combined cycle generation that burns a lot more natural gas would result in higher cost to our customers relative to a simple cycle generator that runs significantly less and burns less natural gas. So those scenarios are certainly possible, but I think our plan appropriately mitigates those risks.
Was this approach driven in any way by Minnesota's renewable standards, the renewable mandate that is in place for Minnesota currently?
It was not. We are driving our planning based on least cost planning, and this two-part plan has been tested against cases with no externality values that Minnesota uses based on the way North Dakota requires us to evaluate it.
Now, this is a question I went back and forth on whether or not it falls under siting or whether or not it falls under end cost to consumers in terms of project costs. So with that in mind, I believe the footprint, if I have this written down correctly, is 13,000 acres of land. So that in itself is more of a siting issue in terms of the land mass. But from a consumer ratepayer standpoint, however, the easements, the payments, are built into the price model.
Correct.
The average, when I've been looking and doing research, is, and it's all over the board, I saw one study where the range was 30 acres up to 141 acres per turbine. I saw another study where it indicated approximately 50 acres per megawatt, or in this case, with the 2-megawatt Vestas, 100 acres. But when I did the math on this, I come up with 173.3 acres per turbine. So, again, now I'm getting into, on one hand, it's in the siting arena, but since easement payments are paid on that additional land, I guess the question for me is, why so many acres per turbine? Even though I realize in the entire project cost, it's a very small, as a percentage amount, but nonetheless, it still falls back to ratepayers.
You know, I can't answer your question in terms of how this project compares to industry standards. What I can say, though, is that we went out and solicited proposals from a variety of developers and a large number of projects, and looked at the overall economics of that whole set of projects, and ultimately determined that the Maricourt project was the least cost alternative for our customers relative to the other options that were in front of us. So from our perspective, while that is a component of cost, in the big picture, we believe we are minimizing the cost to our consumers with the Maricourt project relative to the other options we had available.
No, and I understand that in comparison to other opportunities, but at the same time, I don't know if that, to me, that's not as important a benchmark as whether or not a project is being done in the least costly way. For me, that's the most important part in terms of what's the benchmark, and maybe I'm still dragging some of my private sector experience over 30 years into the equation, and I've been programmed that way. I probably will always be programmed that way. And the placement, I believe, when I was looking at the material, was based on wind studies and where the most optimal locations might be. But it also, I think, offers the opportunity to place more turbines within the same footprint if that need should ever arise down the road, correct?
I don't know that I can answer that question. I think that's a question that the wind developers or under the site permit may be better able to answer than in this proceeding. I just don't have the knowledge.
Okay. I've gotten some background information on this, but just for my own benefit again, can you describe pipeline expansion was cited as being a part of the future load growth forecast? And it's not often, prior to my arrival at the commission, I really didn't think of pipeline expansion as driving. But for anyone listening, can you just, in real basic terms, explain that?
So some of Otter Tail's largest customers have pipelines that extend from Canada and North Dakota east over into Wisconsin to the Chicago area. Those pipelines carrying predominantly crude oil are coming across Otter Tail service territory, and there have been significant expansions at those facilities, and that has resulted in additional load on the Otter Tail system.
Mm-hmm. To compress the gas or to
pump or increase the pressure in the crude pumping, the mm-hmm. crude lines, yeah.
Or the crude, okay. Yeah. Do you have any concern, there's so many wind projects coming online right now, do you have concern about availability of workforce on this project? I know Otter Tail has a good track record of completing projects, quality is there, but there are a lot of, just a number of projects being put forth, not only in North Dakota, but across the country. Do you have any concerns from a labor standpoint?
I don't have any specific concerns, and the management of those projects will be the responsibility of the wind farm developer and not Otter Tail.
Right, but from a timing standpoint?
I am not aware of workforce concerns.
You were very thorough in answering some questions, which knocked out some of my other questions. So, from a capacity side, I think this is the last one. Hoot Lake 2 and 3 are at 141 megawatts. Is that correct from a capacity?
Roughly, yep.
140, 141. Yep. And what is their current level of energy produced?
Yeah, their production in the last 2 to 3 years has been less than a 20% capacity factor due to the changing wholesale energy markets, driven primarily by the significant reduction in natural gas prices, which have suppressed wholesale electricity prices and then just not required that we run those units very often.
Okay. So instead of running those units, and are they fired by Powder River coal?
They are.
They are. Did you experience from a shipping cost, the shipping cost side of things, and just to get my arms a little bit more around the retirement. I realize from reading that MATS was a part of it and some other emission things. Did shipping rates increase substantially when, and I'm assuming the answer is yes, but how detrimental were, I shouldn't say detrimental, but as more Bakken crude was being placed on rail lines, grain cars, for example, the shipping costs went up significantly. I'm assuming the same is true for any commodity moving up and down or goods moving up and down the tracks.
You know, I don't know that I can speak to the rate side, but there was a period of time several years ago where simply getting the deliveries of coal from the Powder River Basin to those units was problematic in terms of keeping an adequate supply, moving to the plants to ensure that they were, you know, had adequate stockpiles of coal. Again, on the rate side, I'm not the right person to speak to how those rates might have changed during that period of time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm just trying to, and it's more just for general knowledge for me, how much added shipping costs, obviously they play into the equation, but was it more on just the fact that upgrading the plant and the cost of upgrades was the driving factor, and increased shipping rates, for example, would be more of a secondary factor in the decision?
I think that is accurate. You know, the plant has really reached the end of its useful life. There would have to be major capital expenditures. Those capital expenditures on new equipment would likely result in additional environmental upgrades. Those are the primary drivers for the retirement of Hoot Lake. But that said, it is a Powder River Basin unit that requires freight to move the coal from the mine to the unit. We generally, as a rule of thumb, suggest that freight is two-thirds of the cost of the delivered fuel to those plants, and so it is a more expensive marginal cost unit because of freight.
But reliability was, and with that component, was, it sounds like more of a driving reason, just wondering if you were going to have an adequate supply on hand at any given time.
That was the problem we ran into several years ago when the entire rail system was congested with Bakken crude being one of the drivers of that.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. I don't have any other questions at this point in time.
Commissioner Chrisman.
Your Honor, did we clarify, is Mr. Tollerson the only witness that's planned, or are there...
My understanding is there's one other witness that's going to be called. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. We would call Mr. Brian Draxton.
So are there specific questions that should be saved for Mr. Draxton, or what will his...
Mr. Draxton could best address our IRP and our planning process and the need basis for these projects, Commissioner.
So, Mr. Tollerson, you said the Hoot Lake plants are 141 each, correct?
No, the total plant is 140 megawatts, the sum of the two units.
Okay, the sum, okay. And what are the reclamation requirements in Minnesota? Will this mean that plant site has to be cleaned up to greenfield status, or what do you have to do there, and are those costs calculated into this?
So the cost of clearing the site is a part of our current depreciation schedule, so we know that we will have costs at the end to demolish the plant. Those are included in our current depreciation schedules or planning for the company. Our plan is to demolish the plant and the unnecessary infrastructure and do any remediation that's required upon closing the plant.
And you said there's power purchase contracts that are expiring. What's about the volume of that capacity?
I might defer that question to Mr. Draxton. in that he'll have better information on the specific contracts involved there. They're both capacity contracts as well as, I know, a 50-megawatt energy purchase, on-peak energy purchase, out through the end of Hoot Lake's operation.
Okay. I'm looking at the settlement agreement that we got a few days ago, and on page 3 in the first full paragraph, it says the project will likely interconnect to a new switching station to be constructed by the co-owners, with the word likely in there. Is that just in there because it hinges on getting MISO's final approval for that plan, or is there still doubts in the company's mind exactly how you're going to interconnect?
Could you bring me back to that reference? I was just a little bit slow in finding the page.
I'm on page 3 of this settlement agreement.
All right.
And then in the first full paragraph, starting in the middle of the third line, it says the project will likely interconnect to a new switching station.
That the project will interconnect to a new switching station in that area. The final plans for the engineering, construction, and precise location of that switching station are still being worked on.
Okay.
But it will interconnect there.
Okay. And then while you have that, jump to page 7. In the very last section 6 there.
Yep.
I read this to say that if Otter Tail fails to qualify for the production tax credits, the company will absorb that loss, not the ratepayers, correct?
If the company fails to qualify for the production tax credit for reasons that are under our reasonable control and we simply are unable to get that done under our control, that is true. The intention, though, is that for circumstances that are outside the company's control, whether it be a change in federal tax policy or any other circumstance that may drive that, we would have the opportunity to come back to the commission and demonstrate why continuing with this project relative to another alternative is still in the best interests of Otter Tail's customers. So what this is intended to do is to keep the door open so that we're not forced into a situation where we would otherwise have to abandon a project. If the project risk or the PTC risk were borne by Otter Tail regardless of what happened in the future for things outside of our control, if there were a reduction in the production tax credit, we would be forced to walk away from the project. We wouldn't be able to incur that risk or bear that cost. It may be in the customer's best interest, in North Dakota consumers' best interest, for us to come back to the commission and say, we've gone out and looked at the market. Maricourt, even with a reduced production tax credit, is still the best option for Otter Tail's customers. Recall that we have a need. We have an energy need that we need to fill. And if it's not Maricourt, it has to be something else. And we just want to make sure that the opportunity to come back and make the best choice as to whether it's a different project or continuing with this project with a reduced production tax credit is in the best interest of customers.
You're not aware at this time of any proposals to change that or to do anything other than the plan, PTC plan, correct?
Correct. I mean, we're aware of current federal tax law and the phase down. Of course, there's all the uncertainty right now about the potential change in federal tax law in general, but that's our awareness at this point.
Okay, and then each of the two projects, Astoria and Maricourt, in this agreement there's kind of limits on how much it is being agreed would be prudent. And if projects come in over that, it would not go to the customers, typically, unless, except for some of the exceptions that have been laid out.
That's right.
What I did not understand in here is, does one offset the other? Let's say one comes in $10 million under the cap and the other is $10 million over. Does that mean it's a wash, or does that mean that one of them came in $10 million over and that amount is not absorbed by the customers?
It is my understanding and read of the settlement agreement that the two projects stand on their own relative to those limits.
Thank you. I have no other questions.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Well, good morning, Brad. Thanks for being here. Some of my questions may fall into Brian's area, but I'll go ahead and ask you, and if you want to defer to Brian, save some for him to answer, that's fine, or I can ask him again, too. Okay. So, essentially, because we don't have a real dynamic resource planning process, long-term resource planning process here that we require the companies go to, you guys file and we review, and but we don't have an exchange like Minnesota does. These kinds of conversations are essentially where we address resource planning. So most of my questions sort of fall along that line of things, and really mostly want to benefit from the company's exercises that you went through all this, so I can understand what appears to be happening in the markets. This is probably the clearest example of the transformation that's occurring that I've seen since I've been on the commission. When you say that a baseload unit is not running as a baseload unit and is being dispatched very irregularly, that speaks to major changes.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me, if you can, what has happened in the MISO market to trigger that, to make your coal facilities basically not run like a baseload unit, but sure, being dispatched to basically follow load or for peaks?
Yep. So we generally think that there are three primary drivers of how the wholesale energy markets have changed. The largest and most significant driver is the great drop in natural gas prices. When we look at the cost of natural gas, and if I can take you through just kind of the basics of the pricing of natural gas units, it'll help you understand. Combined cycle units usually have a heat rate around 7. So if we talk about a natural gas price of $3 an MMBTU, with a heat rate of 7, that means that the energy cost is $21 a megawatt hour, $3 an MMBTU mm-hmm. times the 7. Simple cycle unit would have a heat rate of about 10, so a $3 natural gas price would result in a $30 per megawatt hour energy cost. These older coal units, and Hoot Lake, for instance, have costs of fuel and freight that approach $30 per megawatt hour to operate. So when you simply look at the cost of natural gas at $3 and even well below, I mean, we've had periods in the last year or two where natural gas has been closer to $2 than $3. And so combined cycle generation out there with a heat rate of 7 at $2 natural gas is $14 energy. A 60-year-old coal plant with almost $30 fuel costs can't compete with that, and it's in our customers' best interest to shut that unit down when those prices are much more attractive for us to simply buy in the market. Second factor is, so natural gas prices is number one. We certainly acknowledge that, you know, additional renewables on the system also, you know, have changed the wholesale market dynamic. And then the third piece is that I think there's pretty broad recognition that we haven't seen the rebound in load or load growth since the 2008-2009 period of time that the industry may have otherwise expected. So with reduced demand and more supply, at lower fuel prices, the result has been a wholesale energy market with lower prices.
Mm-hmm. And is that reduced demand also a combination of energy efficiency. What percent would you say is energy efficiency?
This might be one of those that I kicked to Brian. Okay. Energy efficiency plays a large part in the reduced demand. I mean, there are a lot of technologies. LED light bulbs come to mind right off the cuff that result in 1/8 or 1/10 of the energy consumption of a traditional incandescent bulb, and we've seen a lot of implementation of those over the last couple of years. And so energy efficiency is certainly a big component of the reduced demand, or maybe better described as lack of demand growth, because it's netting out a lot of the growth that we would have otherwise seen.
Okay. And then Brian, in his testimony, talked quite a lot about running, and this is just a little heads up to Brian that I'm going to ask him about this. You don't need to go into it because he really does in his testimony, but using the wind plus gas as sort of the new base load. So I want to explore that some with him, but I won't make you go through all that. I will ask you, though, what are you potentially losing by not having a base load unit? Instead of, you know, you're adding wind and gas, running it like base load combined together, what are we losing in that whole transformation?
You know, I think the addition of the natural gas simple cycle unit replaces the energy backstop that we otherwise would have had with a base load unit, only with a tremendous amount of additional flexibility. In that the Astoria project that we are advocating will have the ability to come on quickly. It'll be able to come on multiple times a day. It will be able to ramp very quickly, and it will serve as an energy backstop for our customers if either, one, the renewables aren't producing, or two, energy market prices are high. A coal unit can provide some of those same energy backstop capabilities, but it often takes a day or two to get the unit online, and it doesn't ramp as quickly. So I think most of the energy or financial hedge capabilities of the coal unit will be replaced with the natural gas unit. The other thing I want to point out is that Otter Tail will still have two significant baseload assets at Coyote and Big Stone. So we will still have the benefits of the coal generation in terms of a long-term fuel supply at a relatively stable price for our customers. And really what this portfolio change is accomplishing is making our portfolio more diverse, which in the large picture is beneficial as we look at uncertainties in the future.
What's the capacity of the Big Stone and Coyote together?
Our share of Big Stone is 256 megawatts. Our share of Coyote is 150 megawatts. So just over 400 megawatts combined.
Okay, and what's your total load?
Our
peak load.
Our peak load in the summer is around 800 megawatts.
And what about in the winter?
I believe it's around 100 megawatts higher than that. We are a winter peaking utility.
Did you say 850, so 950?
About 800 in the summer, okay, 900 in the winter, rough justice.
Okay. So the one big loss that I see, and maybe this is just paranoid, but we need to, I think of contingencies. The one big loss with coal versus natural gas is you cannot stockpile natural gas. So there's a lot of crazy people in this world. And even barring a natural disaster, there could be many man-made disasters to impact the delivery of natural gas to a unit in the winter, and you would only have enough generation to cover half your load. And I bet if you look at the MISO market, it's much worse than that. Mm-hmm. So how do you mitigate against those types of situations?
So there are a couple of things that come to mind. One is Astoria will be interconnected to the Northern Border Natural Gas Line, which is a very large interstate natural gas line with a lot of capacity and capability.
Sounds like a great target.
Okay.
Seriously.
And so we've had consultants come in and look and just, you know, give us their opinion on the reliability of those of that particular line looking forward. Second thing is we have an existing natural gas unit up at Solway, Minnesota, that's served by the Great Lakes natural gas line. So the two gas units that we will have will be served by two different lines, which will hedge some of that risk that you're concerned about.
Does Northern Border have redundancy? So if they get a, you know, if it's out along the line at some point, do they have another way to feed that line?
It is my understanding that, yes, if there is a disruption along the line and you can't get flows from the northwest, that flows can be backfed from the southeast.
Okay. Okay. I think I interrupted you. Did you? Were you done?
I'm done.
Sorry. All right. Are there anything else? Is there anything else that the base load offers that natural gas can't? Any other characteristics that the transmission system likes?
Well, you know, I think there are a lot of things that industry is currently looking at in terms of essential reliability services, the study that NERC is undertaking. We clearly have a NOPR now from the Department mm-hmm. of Energy to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. There are concepts such as spinning inertia and what is the value of that to the system. Of course, spinning inertia is only of value if the unit is online and actually spinning. In the case of Hoot Lake, the unit is offline most of the mm-hmm. time based on economics. So I don't know that is something that would be a major concern in this case. I think fundamentally with Hoot Lake, I just circle back that it is a unit that has reached the end of its useful life. Mm-hmm. If we were to try and extend its life in any way to have additional or retain more baseload, it would be a very expensive solution relative to what we are putting forward for our customers right now.
All right. Is this using wind as an energy resource, is that how wind has been used in the past? Is that the typical way?
You know, it's predominantly wind, but we do get some, I'm sorry, predominantly energy, but we do get some capacity value out of the wind resource as well. Mm-hmm. The Mid-Continent ISO does an evaluation that says at the time of the summer peak, how much of a wind resource can we statistically rely on to provide capacity value? And across the Mid-Continent ISO, that's about 15% of nameplate. Out here in the Dakotas, where we have better wind resources, it's into the 20-some percent that we're able to get capacity value. So the answer is wind is predominantly an energy value with some capacity value that comes along.
Okay. You talked a little bit to Brian about the price drop after the PTC goes away, and this came up last week at our hearing with NSP on kind of a similar project, not quite the same, but anyway, in terms of wind resources, and I asked a question and we got almost the same answer as you gave. And so I still don't understand. So I'm going to ask again and ask you to dumb down your answer. When you're pricing for, you know, the 25 years of is it 20 or 25?
25.
25 years. The first 10 years, it's lower because of the PTC, and then the price spikes. Tell me why customers won't see that.
So it's correct that when we do the evaluation, and if we make the assumption that the recovery for the project is through a rider mechanism, mm-hmm. so as the costs and revenues are incurred, we pass those directly through to customers at mm-hmm. the time. we do the evaluation over 25 years, over, you know, all the changes that occur over that time span. We come up with a levelized cost of energy that we use for planning purposes. And going to your point, it is true that for the first 10 years of operation of the facility, the production tax credit will be passed through back to customers through a rider mechanism, provided that's how it works. And customers will see a reduced rate for those 10 years. At the end, when the production tax credit comes off, customer rates will go up, but they will not go above the rate at which they would have otherwise been paying. And again, we have a diagram or a graph in the testimony that demonstrates that that cost does go up, but it still remains below what it otherwise would have been.
Right.
But in response to your question, customers will, at the end of the 10 years, see an increase in rates relative to what they were previously paying.
All right. So that will be, I get that, you know, right now we're looking at 25 years and the levelized cost is lower. That's not going to be real comforting in year 12 when customers see the cost going up. So I think that's something that we all need to be. I probably won't be here, nor will you, but somebody's going to have to deal with that. Well, maybe you will be, Brad. All right. Well, I don't think I'll still be on the commission in 10 years. Okay. Thank you for that clarity. It defied logic to me to think that the customers wouldn't see the rates going up. It won't when the PTC goes off. Okay, then the only other area I want to explore with you is the location. And if you're not the one, I think you are because I think I saw it in your testimony. I want to explore a bit what you went through with North Dakota and trying to look at a location here. Oh, it's page 5. Let's see here. Was that in your testimony? Did you talk about that?
I did talk about that.
Okay. Shoot, I can't find it right now. Well, anyway, so it makes perfect sense that this Astoria should be right, like, less than a mile or so from Northern Border Pipeline. But I was really hopeful that this could help drive some pipeline development in North Dakota. And so as the lessons learned for us here, was there much communication between the company and all the players involved through commerce, through Wahpeton area leadership, through the other utilities to fully explore the needs in that area and how to serve them and how to make this project part of that? And if not, what was missing there and how could we do that better in the future and get that going sooner so that those studies could be done and so that, because this was a real driver that could have served that purpose. Sure. And there's a real need there for natural gas.
Yeah. To give you a little background on what we did do, of course, we generally like to do business in North Dakota and made a good run at trying to find something within the state that might work to compete against the other states. The challenge, of course, we had is that there just weren't any good intersection points for electric transmission and natural gas facilities in the state, and did talk with, for sure, one of the major natural gas transmission line companies that builds those facilities, and had conversations around what their plans were to expand facilities to other communities where it might be synergistic for us to locate a plant. Ultimately, we just didn't find an answer that worked. We also had significant discussions with state government, with the Commerce Commissioner, with the Governor's Chief of Staff. Our president and I actually sat down with the governor himself to talk about what are the opportunities to create incentives to get natural gas out to some of these communities and create intersection points between the natural gas facilities and electric transmission facilities. And ultimately, we never were able to find a solution there that worked either during the time period that we were working with.
What was that time period? Were we just too late in the game, perhaps?
You know, I think at the time, the concern was that in order to figure out solutions through state government, it would take time to get that accomplished if it were possible. And Otter Tail certainly was pushing up against decision timelines on when we would need to proceed. But I also want to add that even had something like that come together, the other challenge is that would have required the construction of new infrastructure, a lateral to some new area of the state where we would have an intersection. We would have ultimately, I mean, the Astoria project or the natural gas project would have had to bear part of the cost of that incremental infrastructure, even if we could have figured out a way for it to work overall. Yep. Keep in mind that Astoria, we are sitting right on the dead intersection of a major transmission line and a major natural gas line. So I think what I can say is that, I mean, we feel like we gave it our best effort to try and figure out a way for North Dakota to have a site that could compete. Ultimately, we were just unsuccessful. We couldn't find that spot or that solution.
Was the Alliance, what are the problems with the Alliance line?
The Alliance line has natural gas liquids included in it, so it's not, you know, simple traditional natural gas. So you have two alternatives. You either put in a facility to strip out the liquids and sell those or re-inject them after you use your natural gas. That is a cost-prohibitive capital expenditure. The other alternative is that you just acknowledge you're going to pay significantly more for your natural gas because you're burning not only traditional natural gas but the natural gas liquids, which have a higher commodity value, and then you're operating costs or your fuel costs into the future are significantly higher. Neither of those alternatives were attractive to us.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate your testimony.
Let me go around to attorneys first. Mr. Stephenson, do you have any follow-up questions?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Armstrong?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
No, sir.
Commissioners? Commissioner Crocius?
I do not.
Chairman Christman.
Are you also in the process of seeking advanced determinations of prudence from South Dakota and Minnesota on these facilities?
We are not. We in Minnesota, our project was approved as a part of our integrated resource plan. In South Dakota, we have no active docket, but keep in mind that South Dakota is a very small jurisdiction for Otter Tail in terms of overall cost recovery of any facility.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchik, any other questions?
No, thank you.
All right, Mr. Stephenson, I think witness can step down. Thank you, Mr. Tollerson. You can call your next witness.
Thank you, Your Honor. Otter Tail Power calls Brian Braxton.
Mr. Braxton, you were in the room when I gave the perjury admonition, so I'll ask you to raise your right hand. Do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Thank you. Mr. Stephenson.
Please state your name for
the record. Brian Draxton.
And where are you employed, Mr. Braxton?
I am the manager of resource planning at Otter Tail Power Company.
And how long have you been in that position?
Approximately 10 years.
And have you submitted your testimony
in this matter?
I have. And are you here today in support of the settlement agreement?
Yes, I am.
This witness is available for cross-examination.
Mr. Armstrong.
No questions.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle.
No questions.
Commissioner Crocius.
Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
Can you explain or just give me a better handle on... Well, I'll ask the first question, and again, I was doing some research the past several evenings, and a wind turbine, from what I read, loses about 1.6% of its efficiency on an annual basis. I don't know if that number would be disputed, and another study would say it loses 0.8%, one would say it loses 2.1%. But how is that factored in over the life of, you know, say there's a 20-year life, that would, the simple math on that would be a 32% decrease in efficiency. So how do you weigh that out? Is that factored in?
I hate to start out with my very first question being one I can't answer, but I believe that'd be one I'd need to have Mr. Sinstelin answer.
Okay. Okay, then how about this one? Well, here, I'll throw a real easy one. Do you plan to be here in 10 years?
No.
Okay.
What was that answer? I didn't hear that.
On the earth or here?
Either one.
I don't think it matters what you plan.
I'm not gonna press. I don't want to get you in trouble. So probably already did. Why not rebuild at Hoot Lake?
You know, that was our very first choice. Fergus Falls, Minnesota is our headquarters town, and you know, there's 40-some jobs that are at Hoot Lake plant and property taxes being paid to the city and the school district. So, yes, that would have been our first choice to stay in our town. However, again, like Mr. Tollerson talked about, natural gas, we don't have sufficient natural gas supply in Fergus Falls to run a natural gas plant like Astoria. So we would have had to build a natural gas line, I believe it's from the Viking pipeline, would have been one, which was coming through that Heart of Lakes area. And you can imagine the windy path and all of the problems you would have trying to go through Minnesota Lakes country with a gas pipeline. The other option was to come from down near Wahpeton, the same pipeline that's going to be going to Gwinner. And again, we have the natural gas liquids issue. And both of them had about a 40-mile distance, so added $30 to $40 million to our cost.
Okay. In fact, I think that was the number. I had written down $30 million just from taking a look at. I guess I'm not sure where that number came from, other than I know I've pestered a little bit on, well, why didn't the gas plant land in North Dakota? Because we want to, you know, and it probably sound like a broken record, but, you know, when we have projects, to have them partnered together and having the wind, having the, in this case, the gas plant land in North Dakota and just the economic benefits. And I realize that a lot of it falls back on the state Department of Commerce, what they're willing to do to help out, and local municipalities as well, what they may be willing to do to try and get something located. But certainly something we can, you know, we'll want to continue looking at in the future from an economic development standpoint. Did you have any insight on the acreage question that I had?
I do not.
You do not. Okay. Then at this point in time, I don't think I have any other questions.
Commissioner Christman.
Good morning, Brian. I only have a couple questions regarding the power purchase agreements that are expiring. So what's the volume there? Is it in a series of a couple of agreements or a series of a dozen agreements, and are they renewable? Tell me about them.
So if you would look at page 4 on my testimony in either Maricourt or Astoria, it appears at the same place, and there is a listing there of the capacity contracts that we have. And you can see that all of them are with Great River Energy, and they vary from 50 to 100 megawatts. Page 4.
Of your
of my testimony.
Direct?
Yes.
It's Exhibit 4.
Okay.
Okay, I had neglected to mark that. Sorry.
Okay. So you can see there that the final one ends in May 31 of 2021. So what we've attempted to do is match our capacity shortfalls very carefully with these purchases so that we keep our excess capacity to a minimum. We're buying just enough to meet our MISO requirements. And so we've pieced these together with Great River Energy over the past several years, I guess to keep our costs down to customers and then also to have them expire concurrently with the retirement of Hoot Lake plant so that they can be replaced with the capacity from our Astoria project.
So they're expiring because you chose to have them expire. They would have been renewable, though, had you chosen to negotiate something.
We could attempt to see if they had capacity available again. Yes, we could ask. And I also neglected one. We also have an energy purchase contract with Northern States Power, and that is a 5x16 on-peak, which means 5 days a week, and the 16 on-peak hours each day through 2020, yes. And so that expires, you know, nearly at the same time that Astoria will come online. I mean, that Maricourt will come online.
But is there any reason to believe that these would not be renewable, the GRE?
The GRE, no, I believe that we could have attempted to renew those.
That's all I got. Thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Okay, Brian. So let's talk about it's page 8 of your testimony. On the bottom, you say you're talking about the wind plus gas configuration compared to other approaches, and really what I'm seeing it as the new baseload, or maybe baseload just doesn't exist anymore. It's this. I'm not saying it won't exist in any shape, but it seems to me that it's decreasing a lot and it's being replaced with this approach. Is that a correct analysis?
Yes, throughout our upper Midwest, we are seeing some coal plants being retired, baseload coal plants, and they are being replaced with gas and renewables, and both simple cycle and combined cycle. So I really believe that baseload will continue to have a very important purpose into the future. And like Mr. Tollerson said, we still have 400 megawatts of baseload coal, and I believe that's going to be important going into the future. But it is declining in both the amount and how much those coal facilities are dispatched.
What do you think will be the driver for the back? So how much of this formula can be allowed onto the transmission grid to keep it reliable? I mean, what do you see as the backstop for the retirement of the baseload and replacing it in this way?
I would say that both gas combined cycle and then our proposal with simple cycle gas and wind, I believe that they can take the place of baseload as it retires, except that, you know, we'll be limited by the transmission system. So the transmission would need to be in place in the right places to allow that to take the place of baseload. Mm-hmm. But from the generation itself, it can do what the baseload does.
Is there components that are lost?
You know, I think Mr. Tollerson addressed that question, and I think I'd have pretty much the same answer, yeah. You know, they ramp, like our Hoot Lake plant, for instance, takes a day or two to get it up to capacity. It's very hard to run it up and down to as MISO needs it. And it's expensive. And, again, we see this natural gas wind being significantly cheaper for customers. Plus, I think it gives us a more diverse resource mix for our customers.
He said something interesting, because we hear about the spinning reserves a lot and as a value that we need to maintain and have functioning on the grid. But he said you only have it when it's spinning. And so if a lot of these aren't spinning, how important is that? Or where are they spinning? Has MISO figured that out, how much spinning reserves they need? And are they protecting that?
I can't answer if MISO's determined that amount.
Who should be determining that amount? Do you guys look at that?
You know, I guess I'm not sure on that.
Because I kind of fear that it's like this. You guys think MISO is, we think MISO is, MISO thinks we are, we think you are. You know, it's like, but who's doing that?
So I think that's one of the things, though, that adding our natural gas facility does is it gives us a very large amount of spinning reserves. Hoot Lake, for instance, at 140 megawatts, is turned off much of the year. So if we need spinning reserves, that's not there. The natural gas plant, however, can come up to full capacity in 5 minutes or so, 10 minutes. And so there we have a spinning reserve capability that I think – so I think this resource that we're adding, we're actually – giving our customers and the MISO region, you know, more spinning reserve capability than it had without our project.
but at probably a higher cost than what people are accustomed to with a coal plant. If you needed it a lot.
If we needed it a lot, although, as Mr. Tollerson said, the energy from the Astoria facility with natural gas prices today may actually be lower than Big Stone or Hoot Lake. But, again, we can't know that it's always going to be that way.
Right. Do you address this issue in Minnesota with your integrated resource planning?
Spinning reserves specifically?
Spinning reserves and some of these other intangibles.
I would say that they are not components of our plan that we submit in Minnesota.
Okay.
Specifically.
So that leads me to believe that we're all counting on MISO to do that.
They would definitely have an important role.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe FERC. I mean, this is one of the issues that is part of this new requirement from the Energy Secretary, right?
Right.
A request.
Right. And so I think, you know, there is a push to try and put value on those. Mm-hmm.
Have you seen anything happen, any spikes or any warnings or alerts or anything from MISO that would suggest that this is more of an issue than we think at any point during the year? Have you been like, ooh, yikes?
You know, I probably wouldn't be the person to speak to what we've seen from MISO there. There was some MaxGen alerts recently in those mm-hmm. really hot, humid days, but I don't believe it ever got to the point of causing problems. It was just, you know, getting ready to in case something happened.
And then in those MaxGen alerts, did you turn on Hoot Lake then? Or what happens with you guys?
You know, Hoot Lake has run off and on this summer in some of the hot weather. I can't answer specifically if it was running on those days a couple of weeks ago, but it has run during hot days. MISO has called on it.
But then you'd have this, Astoria, in place of it, so you'd call on this. And
right.
You'd be covered.
Right.
Okay. I might maybe should have asked Brad this, but how does the volatility of the pipeline load impact your plans? Because that's pretty tough to predict whether those pipelines are going to go through or not.
Oh, okay.
You know, the pipelines. I'm sorry. Pipeline. No, the crude oil pipelines in Minnesota, the Enbridge, largely the Enbridge issues.
Yeah, they are. That's a very volatile issue. We are planning for some growth. The other thing that we've done with MISO is we have this firm service level so that they've contractually agreed with us that if MISO comes out or if we want to shut down, control the load to keep our costs lower to customers, they have to shed load to this certain level. So while there's growth there from an energy standpoint, we still have the ability to not let that drive our demand up. So, you know, we've got some mechanisms in place to control that, but it's probably one of our biggest strategic issues that we have to deal with at our company, having such a large customer with such unpredictable futures.
Mm-hmm. Can you share with us what that load is, or is that private?
I guess that would be a trade secret number.
No.
Yes.
It's always safe to say no, right? Oh, you attorneys need to go like this more often. let's see. And then, let's see. Brad talked about how if natural gas prices go up, this project becomes even, project becomes even smarter from an economic standpoint. And we heard this last week as well. And Brian was pursuing this line of thinking. I wanted to go through it a little bit further. What I think he's thinking, what I'm thinking is, yeah, if you can rely on wind all the time, it becomes smarter. But we're assuming you're going to have to back it up too, because it isn't going to blow all the time. Some days in North Dakota, like today, it isn't blowing. Right. So doesn't that make the price you have to plan for the backup. So doesn't that threaten the economics of this project?
So I would say I would agree with what Brad said. So as natural gas prices go up, first of all, let's compare this project to a combined cycle project. Combined cycle project is going to be running 50, 60, 70% of the time. So a rise in gas prices definitely is going to cause the energy cost to go up for consumers.
Sure.
Our project, on the other hand, serves more as a hedge. If we need to run it, and let's just use, for example, our energy's at $30, mm-hmm. So that would really limit our customers' exposure. I guess we're talking about natural gas prices going up, though, aren't we?
Right.
So we'll say that it goes way up. We always that's a hedge for us. If the MISO market price that was available to us is less, we would buy energy from the market instead. But the Astoria plant would limit our customers to the highest it could go because we could always run it at that natural gas price. So we see that as a hedge for our customers. It doesn't burn a lot of natural gas, but if market prices go very high, it will serve as a cap on what our customers have to pay.
So if the natural gas prices go up a lot, and you must have looked at that scenario in the strategist model.
We did. We use plus 25%. Plus 50% and plus 100%, so a doubling of natural gas prices.
Okay. And in all those, this was by far the cheapest.
It was, yes.
Over anything else, including, say, a new coal. I know maybe you didn't even model that. Did you
I don't
even model
think we
that
even
anymore?
Modeled that anymore.
Hmm. Okay. All right. Thank you, Brad.
Okay. Additional questions for Mr. Draxton. Mr. Stephenson?
No, Your
Honor. Mr. Armstrong?
No.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
No.
Mr. Crocious?
Just one follow-up that Commissioner Fedorchak, Julie, just prompted me. By 2021, you've anticipated a capacity deficit of 273 megawatts. So if the wind is at a 50.7% net capacity factor. We'll just use some easy math on it. A little more than 75, 76, 77 megawatts in terms of energy. And the gas plant is a 250 megawatt. I mean, in a perfect world, at the 50.7%, you would be in the 325, 326 range. And at 273, so there's a 52, call it a 50 megawatt cushion in the whole scenario. Is that with Hoot Lake completely out of the, I realize it's going to be retired, but were those numbers assuming Hoot Lake was at 20 as it is now or at zero?
Okay, so first of all, it assumes Hoot Lake is gone. So mm-hmm. the MISO planning year goes from June 1 mm-hmm. to May 31st of the following year. So our shutdown of Hoot Lake will be May 31 of 2021. Mm-hmm. And we will then have Astoria accredited and ready to go for the June 1, 2021, the next MISO planning year. So yeah, one drops off, the next one comes on. Second of all, I need to change your math a little bit. The 50% thing is nice and easy. But really, that's the capacity factor mm-hmm. From an energy standpoint throughout the year. But as Mr. Tollerson talked about earlier, the accredited capacity we get is what that wind farm happens to be putting out at the time of MISO's summer peak. So we would expect our capacity accreditation of AmeriCorps to be more in the 22-25% range. So that 75 number drops in half approximately.
Okay.
So now we have a much smaller, I don't know, you had the math in front of you, maybe you can redo our
15. If I took 37.5 off of the 52. Okay. Yet.
So again, and the other thing about resource additions, they're lumpy. You can't add chunks of generation to exactly match your increases.
Right.
So part of the thing we looked at with Astoria being a 250-megawatt project is we looked at the range of sizes that were the most economic. And so, yes, we will have a bit of length, but a very small amount. We can resell that capacity and energy into the MISO market. And we just think it's wise. And really the only way to do business is to be just a little bit over what mm-hmm. you need.
Sure. No, I understand that. Okay. Now, that helps out a lot. Then one other final question. you had talked about that you like to do business in North Dakota. You like to cite projects or have them cited in North Dakota. We were talking about the gas project in particular. Since that's not happening, when you work with companies like EDF, does origin of labor come into the equation at all?
Could you tell me, what do you mean by original labor, just availability?
Where the workforce is going to come from, or is it really you're looking at the bid and you're not taking it beyond that?
You know, I would say that us as a company look at the bid.
Right.
We have to count on the developer like EDF to have the wherewithal to know that they have a labor ability available to build the project for the prices that they're quoting us.
Okay. Well, I think you know where my preference is right. on that. So, all right. No other questions for me.
Chairman Christman.
Why 245? Was it 245 or what was the size of Astoria?
250.
250. Why 250? Is that something that they are becoming like when we used to site a bunch of peaking plants out west? They were almost off-the-shelf units. They're 45 megawatts, and you take one or two or three. Is that how these are, or could you have built this 230 or 210 or 340 or whatever you wanted?
So, really, I probably should have Mr. Swanson answer that, but I'll take a stab, and if you feel like I'm way off, you can throw something at me. But so, really, there's some major suppliers, and I know three that come to mind are General Electric, Mitsubishi, and Siemens, for instance. And they all make a different machine. So what we did was pick a class machine around that 250 megawatt size. When we go out for bids, we may get a 240 or a 257. We just don't know what size exactly the configuration will be that comes in. But then we will choose the least cost one for customers. So because we've modeled 250, we can't guarantee that it's going to be 250. Most likely it will be something a little bit different.
So why wouldn't you have shot for something around 150 in that you're replacing a coal plant that's 141, you're backing up a wind farm that's 150? Why did you shoot for around 250?
One other thing to keep in mind there, Commissioner, is the approximately 50 to 100 megawatts of capacity purchases that also disappear at the end of 2021. So that together with Hoot Lake pushes us up to that range.
Funny, I forgot that because that actually leads. That has to do with my next question again.
Which you've forgotten, but now I remember.
No, last week I let it go, and earlier this morning I let it go. But after hearing the explanation the second time, I'm going to push back a little bit. We are told that this becomes an even more wonderful plan if gas prices rise dramatically. And it seems to me that the rationale for that answer is, in comparison to building a different gas plant that would run all the time as opposed to just one that backs up the wind. But it seems to me there's another option here. What about how would a large spike in gas prices under this scenario compare to a long-term contract with another company that has coal capacity available at existing plants that is not getting all their power sold? You're dropping several contracts here.
Right.
Not quite as much volume, but hearing stories from other coal plants, I'm thinking there's more contracts that would be available to you.
There are. And I think one of the things you need to keep in mind, so every year MISO has a capacity auction that takes place. And if you look at just that next capacity auction or 1 year into the future, you can buy capacity really pretty inexpensively. But when you start trying to go out and get capacity in that 2021 time frame, 2022, 2023, which we've done and asked about that, there's a lot of uncertainty in this industry when you start getting out 4, 5, 6, 7 years. We don't know what's going to happen with prices, with environmental regulations, pipeline construction, all of that kind of stuff. There's a lot of uncertainty. And what we find is that while there's capacity available today and companies in our neighborhood are willing to talk about selling you some for next year or the year after. As you start getting out more years, the prices rise dramatically. And when we looked at that out in that 2021-2022 time frame, not only do the prices rise dramatically, but the vendors are much less willing to sell you capacity at that time just because of their uncertainty, and they want to make sure that they have enough and the right kind of capacity. So we found the offers to be shrinking a lot and the prices to be going way up.
Thank you.
Mr. Fedorchak.
So you're saying there isn't coal capacity to be purchased in 5 to 10 years?
I would say, no, I wouldn't say that. There is. The number of people offering it are way less than the number of people that would offer it 1 or 2 years out, and the prices get up to be very, very expensive.
Okay. So is that modeled? Did you model that in the strategist too, as compared to a 100% increase in gas prices?
I would say that we did not model those options.
Why not?
I think it was what we would call a pre-screening. So we would go through and look at these kind of things. So as we got some indicative pricing in 2021 through 2025 kind of time frame, the numbers that we saw there were just, we just did some simple math and did a comparison and just determined that they would be just too expensive.
So it wouldn't have, you kind of modeled it yourself?
Sort of. Before we got
into
strategist.
What, yes. You would have.
And when I'm, Commissioner Fedorchak, when I'm talking about less, you know, when if we go out for capacity for next year, we can probably get, I don't know, 12 or 15 offers for capacity mm-hmm. within the upper part of MISO. When we went out there, we were finding like one or two. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very, very tight. People are just unwilling to dive in. The other thing we found, too, is, you know, we could easily be second-guessed, too, if we jumped into a very expensive contract, and then all of a sudden when we get out there, the prices for that capacity are much lower.
Right.
You know, then it's questionable that we make a good decision, too.
So what does that tell us about those facilities or longer term, like 5 years from now, 10 years from now? What should we be reading into the fact that they are unwilling to commit and if they do, their prices are going to be high?
About those coal facilities? Mm-hmm. I think it's the uncertainty. I think that's just generally there's a lot of uncertainty. There could be some very significant environmental things that come up, depending on, you know, what the administration is going to be in the future. Natural gas prices, companies don't know what natural gas prices are going to be into the future. And I just think there's a real hesitancy to make commitments that far out.
Okay. So then I want to ask you about the doomsday scenario, too. Is there enough consideration being made on the risk that the natural gas pipelines in this country have and the amount of reliability that we're tying them to the grid? And, you know, are we looking at that enough?
I should probably run for office, but I'm going to say I don't know if I did give you something, it would just totally be opinion. I don't know that I have any factual or educated answers on that.
Well, give us your opinion. The attorney is not shaking
right.
his head.
I haven't heard it.
So the last thing they tell me is
I haven't heard an objection yet. So you're okay.
You know, is there a doomsday? You know, I'm personally not one to believe that the doomsday things would happen. Is it possible? I guess it is. But hopefully the natural gas industry is built. I know like Mr. Tollerson talked about the Northern Border Pipeline. If there was a problem on that, it can also be fed back up from the south. You know, it doesn't have to, it's not a one-directional mm-hmm. pipeline. So hopefully there are those types of things that have been built into the natural gas infrastructure to, you know, at a very high level, keep gas flowing to major parts of the country. Not a very good answer for you, but.
Well, I wish that this would show up on the radar more often because that is a really valuable aspect about coal. And saving some of those resources in strategic areas throughout the country so we can keep the grid up if somebody decides to attack our natural gas infrastructure because it's really vulnerable. And you weren't here during Dakota Access, so you didn't see
right.
how animated these people are.
Right.
This is a religion to some people. So there's no, like, boundaries as to what's off, out of, like, what you can't do
right.
to to push this cause. So I think it's pretty realistic that we'll see that. But anyway, thank you.
Okay, let's take a break. It's a little after 10. Let's take about a 10-minute break. Be back by 10:12, 10:13, somewhere in there. Sorry, it's 10:13. We said 10:12 and a half, 10:13. Okay. All right, back on the record. Mr. Draxson is gone, I guess. He's not in the room at the moment. Okay, let's do some procedural things for the good of the order here and find out. Mr. Stephenson, do you plan at this time to call any additional witnesses today? I know you initially indicated to me only two.
Your Honor, no, we do not plan to call any additional witnesses, although all the witnesses that submitted direct testimony in this matter are here.
They are available and they are here. Because there have been some references to the possibility of a couple of questions that could be answered better by those people. So I want to ask the commissioners or counsel whether they feel the need to hear from Mr. Sinstelin or Mr. Swanson or any other of the other company witnesses to ask those questions. Let's start with the commissioners, I guess. Commissioner Crocius.
I would like to have the one question answered in terms of turbines slowly losing efficiency over their lifespan. And I believe, Brian, you indicated that another person might be able to answer that question.
Right. I guess that would be witness Harvey McMahon.
Okay.
Okay, and commissioners, any of the other witnesses? I know there were references to some other names as well in the testimony. Or, I mean, Mr. Stephenson did propose off the record the possibility of a late-filed exhibit to answer those questions as well. So,
I'm fine, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Fedorchik?
Whatever these, I think those were questions you two had, so whatever you decide.
Okay. All right. Okay, Mr. Stephenson, or Stephenson, are we done with Mr. Draxton? Or
we are done with Mr. Draxton,
okay.
Your Honor.
Mr. Armstrong?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Commissioners? Anything else more for Mr. Draxton? Okay, he's off the hot seat.
He's not even going to be here in 10 years.
We don't know where he's going to be in 10 years, but he'll be out of here as quickly as he can. Okay, Mr. Stephenson.
We would call Harvey McMahon to the stand.
Mr. McMahon, you were also in the room when I gave the perjury admonition this morning, so I'll just ask you to raise your right hand. You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
Yes.
All right, thank you. Mr. Stephenson.
Mr. McMahon, where are you employed?
Otter Tail Power.
And what do you do there?
I'm the manager of renewables.
And have you submitted direct testimony in this matter?
Yes.
And are you here today in support of the settlement agreement?
Yes.
This witness is available for cross-examination, Your Honor.
Mr. Armstrong.
No questions.
Commissioners, Commissioner Crocius.
Okay, the question I had, and I don't know if this is an accurate figure or not, but just that, and it made sense to me that as a turbine is put into operation over the course of time, it will slowly lose a small incremental amount of efficiency. Is that true?
That's not been our experience. We've got three wind farms operating right now. The oldest one is about 10 years old. And the net capacity factor that we had expected at the beginning of the operation is still, we're seeing that today. A lot of that information depends on the maintenance that you do to these units and which kind of units you have, and whether you've got a Tier 1 unit or some of the lower-tiered units.
Okay.
But our again, our experience has been we've not seen the drop-off that you're talking about.
Okay. Yeah, the number that I was referring to, the 1.6%, was published in the journal Renewable Energy. So that is, in the course of doing some other research on the project, I came across that number. And of course, it caught my attention when I started to think of the lifespan of a facility of a wind turbine. And if it's dropping 1.6% a year, that becomes quite significant over the course of time. But your experience, as stated, however, is that with proper maintenance, there is no fall-off?
That we haven't seen that, correct. Okay. I mean, whether there is or there isn't, and people can do studies on that kind of stuff and come up with answers, but our experience has been that we have not seen that drop-off.
Okay.
And the other question that you had is Florida. 10 years from now.
Oh. How come everybody else gets to leave in 10 years? Perfect. Okay, thank you. I appreciate that, the answer.
Commissioner Christman.
Your Honor, I have no serious questions.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
So as long as you're here and you're an expert in this area, well, I'll ask you about what you are seeing in terms of the lifespan of your wind facilities and the operation and maintenance costs, and are they lower, higher, about what you predicted? And so just share some of that information with us.
I'm going to look for nods and shakes from a particular person, but I believe our O&M costs have been lower than what we initially had expected. So yes, the cost would be lower. What was your other question?
The lifespan. They're usually 20 to 25 years. Are you thinking that's about right? Are they going to last longer than that?
I believe they'll last longer.
Longer.
Yeah. And it's going to depend on what your maintenance practices are. One of the things that Otter Tail has done is we put in a condition-based monitoring system, which is vibration monitoring on the towers themselves. And we have found that our failure rates have dropped significantly compared to other wind towers likely situated. And we've done some other things in terms of...
And what is a failure? Like, does it work anymore? It just stops?
Most of the time, failure is going to be a gearbox. Your drivetrain tends to be the one piece of equipment in a wind farm that has an issue. Drivetrain being your gearbox and that kind of stuff.
And you have to replace those?
We have been able to replace bearings because we've been able to find situations before other people are able to find these situations. Now, understand we have one particular manufacturer that we're working with so far, and I know other manufacturers of wind turbine generators have vibration monitoring already installed when they first go up. The new Vestas units that we're looking at here, they do have this vibration monitoring, so we're looking forward to operating these.
Do they have a warranty for a certain number of years, most
yes.
of this? How long are those warranties?
I think it varies. What the exact warranty in our situation is, I think, would be confidential. I mean, not to you guys, but it's, what am I looking
trade
for?
Secret.
Trade secret. It would be trade secret. But in general, they will last between 2 and 5 years.
The
warranties, yes.
Okay. All right, thanks. I think that's it for me.
Mr. Nothing. Stephenson.
Oh, I do have one more, sorry.
Okay, go ahead.
Got to go around the loop?
Oh, you're okay. Go ahead.
what about repowering? Have you guys looked at repowering any of your facilities yet? Are they old enough? What will trigger that?
We have looked at it. And, you know, again, it comes down to what makes economic sense for our customers as to whether or not we would pursue that.
Okay. And are you aware of whether or not you can use equipment purchased under Safe Harbor PTC for repowering? and still get then PTC for 10 years on a repowered unit. Do you know anything about that?
I do not know enough to make a comment
okay.
on it.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, any additional questions for Mr. McMahon?
No, Your Honor.
No.
Sure. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
No, thank you.
Commissioners?
I have just one. This is actually a pretty easy question, I think, but the Vestas, and maybe it's just coincidental, but I've seen more and more of those that make pop up as of late. Is that is it price point? Are they the Cadillac of wind turbines with the anti-vibration device built in or a detector built in? You know, if you were selling, you've got Ford, Chevy, whatever, but, you know, from a wind turbine perspective, why the Vestas?
You know, I think Ford, Chevy, and Ram are all great vehicles. In the same token, I think all the Tier 1 wind turbine generators, all of them are good applications for specific sites. For the Mericourt site, the Vestas V110 gave us the most net capacity factor. And when you start looking at net capacity factor and price, the V110 was the best choice for Mericourt. But doesn't necessarily mean it's the best choice for all sites.
Okay. Does it adapt to changing wind patterns better than other models?
I don't, not that I know of.
Okay.
It's the, as a Tier 1 supplier for this site, it's as good as any of the top units.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. I think you're okay, Mr. McMahon. You can step down. Mr. Stephenson, anything else?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. So Otter Tail rests. Mr. Armstrong.
Oh, Victor Schiff.
Mr. Shook, you know the drill, so raise your right hand. You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding.
I do.
Thank you. Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you. Victor, where do you work?
Work for the Public Service Commission.
And what's your position?
I'm a public utility analyst.
What do you do in that position?
I review rate cases, advanced determinations of prudence, damage prevention, kind of the whole gamut of public utility cases.
And you're assigned to advocacy staff in this proceeding, correct?
Correct.
You prepared an opening statement?
I have.
Could you please read that for us?
I will. Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Victor Shook. I'm representing advocacy staff in this proceeding. I'm testifying today in support of the settlement agreement between Otter Tail Power Company and advocacy staff. The settlement agreement grants conditional prudence for the 250-megawatt Astoria Natural Gas Combustion Turbine Project, as well as conditional prudence and a certificate of public convenience and necessity for the 150-megawatt Mericourt Project. Based on the analysis completed by both Otter Tail Power and our consultant, PA Consulting, I believe the Astoria and Mericourt projects are prudent resource decisions that will provide Otter Tail's North Dakota ratepayers with the least cost option to serve their future energy and capacity needs. These cases are unique in that Otter Tail is proposing them as a package, unlike others we've seen in the past, where utility will propose either a wind or a natural gas combustion turbine project. Two projects are proposed as a package by Otter Tail in order to replace the capacity and energy currently provided by their Hoot Lake plant and a number of capacity purchase agreements that are expiring. The Hoot Lake plant, which is fired by Powder River Basin Coal from Wyoming, is scheduled to be retired in 2021. Capacity purchase agreements are short-term purchases that will expire at the same time Hoot Lake plant will be retired. This planning allows Otter Tail to maximize economies of scale by building larger new facilities rather than many smaller ones. And the conditional prudence of these projects is based upon specific total capital costs per project. If the actual cost of either project exceeds the agreed-upon amounts, Otter Tail would need to come before the Commission for a prudence determination for the additional costs. Conversely, if either of the project's actual costs come in lower than agreed-upon amounts, Otter Tail will only receive recovery of the actual project costs. This is in line with traditional rate making. In addition to these provisions, the settlement agreement also defines Otter Tail's reporting requirements for the projects. Otter Tail must provide quarterly construction project reports for both projects until they're placed into service.
They must also provide monthly curtailment and negative pricing observations within their monthly fuel cost reports for the AmeriCorps project once it's placed into service. And finally, they must file an annual letter with the Commission regarding the status of the trade secret information in this docket. Therefore, I recommend the Commission adopt the settlement agreement. I look forward to answering any questions you may have.
End of the witness.
Mr. Stephenson, I'll start with you.
Nothing, Your Honor.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle.
I have no questions.
Mr. Kroos.
Oh, good morning, Victor. Any significant concerns with the project as you were reviewing the material?
No.
Okay. Everything's pretty straightforward to you?
I feel it is. Yeah.
Did you take a look at the question I had asked earlier about turbines potentially becoming less efficient over the course of time?
It's not something I've looked into specifically. I would agree with what Otter Tail's witness stated as far as, you know, what our experience is with the turbines in North Dakota. I've looked at our capacity factors for North Dakota wind projects, and I haven't seen that kind of a drop-off in the turbines I've reviewed.
Yeah, right. I'm going to do some more digging on that myself just to see if that could easily be a number that's been applied to old technology. That was certainly less efficient when you look at turbines manufactured, put in service 20 years ago, significantly different than today. Well, I don't have any other questions for you, Victor, because I'm not going to ask where you're going to be in 10 years, but I'm going to be nice because I know you'll be here on Monday morning.
Better be.
We rely on staff quite heavily to get the work done.
Mr. Chrisman.
Have you done any of your own research or have any knowledge about what would be available for long-term contracts for coal-fired power? Or do you agree with the company witness that said that beyond the first couple years, there's very few options available?
I have not done any research, so I couldn't really speak to that. What the company stated does not seem out of line with other things that I've seen out there. But again, I haven't really looked into the matter specifically.
Do you have concerns about the long-term volatility of gas prices with more and more reliance around the, not North Dakota necessarily independently, but the region, the RTO, with getting more and more reliant on gas and the... And if
it is a concern for over the long term that I have that, you know, really our main options right now are wind and gas facilities, and creates a lot of reliance on that. I think this project tries to balance those risks over the long term, but kind of as the RTOs and the nation as a whole, having very limited choices for serving our energy needs, it's concerning, yes.
And do you agree with Mr. Tollerson that these are independent projects as far as the ultimate cost of them, that if one came in underpriced and the other came in overpriced, the underpriced one does not offset that overage?
That's correct.
Okay. No other questions. Thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Just one additional question to what the previous two asked. In this and last week's cases, we both the settlements require that we get monthly curtailment and negative pricing observations. Why are we? What is that going to show us? Are we asking for that?
Just to ensure we're actually getting the value for the project. So on the AmeriCorps project, if there were curtailments for some reason, that's energy that or low cost energy that our customers should be having access to that for whatever reason they weren't. So if we
would
see that number,
automatically be paying a higher price then, you think, if there's curtailments of this?
Depending on the reason, I guess. You know, I mean, curtailments happen for lots of different reasons. It could be that primarily the grid would be overwhelmed. You know, a transmission line mm-hmm. somewhere is overloaded, which would probably lead to a curtailment. So in that case, we would likely be subject to higher market prices. So it's really more of a monitor for us to keep an eye on. So if we see a large number of curtailments happening.
There's really nothing there's no built-in protection for customers against that, though, just the monitoring of it. Right?
Correct. But the monitoring would provide us, you know, something to take, you know, further action if we saw that number growing, to open a further, you know, a deeper investigation into what's causing this and is there's something, some action taken by the company or another party to cause this.
Okay. And then if we did that, would we have some options, do you think, to address those? Any ideas of what those might be?
I think they could be kind of all over the board, but, you know, generally you can always, you know, so if the circumstances change, you can always kind of rehash the prudence of something if there are new facts available. So that would be my assumption, is if something like that is happening or, you know, we see something happening differently than what we're expecting and proposing here today, that could potentially be a changing of the facts and a re-review of the prudence of the projects.
Is there a lot of curtailments of the wind in North Dakota now? Is that a problem?
Not that I'm aware of.
And the expansion of the grid, this one is connected to the Big Stone, or the Ellendale, what
Big
is that
Stone,
one
Brookings,
called?
I
Big
think.
Stone. Brookings to Big Stone. This connects through that as well?
Correct.
So that should reduce the likelihood of curtailments being a problem?
Yes, for the time being.
But they don't have an interconnect yet?
Not yet.
Okay. All right, thank you, Victor.
Counsel, Mr. Stephenson?
Nothing, Your Honor.
Mr. Armstrong?
Nothing.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
Nothing.
Okay, Commissioners, anything else? All right, you may step down, Mr. Shook. Mr. Armstrong?
Staff rest.
Okay. At this point, I guess I'll ask again. I did ask earlier if there's any public comment or public input with regard to these projects. Seeing none, we'll move on to talk about whether council would like to make any closing remarks.
No, Your Honor, nothing for Ottertail.
Mr. Armstrong?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
No, thank you.
Okay, and what about preparing proposed findings and conclusion based on the settlement agreement and an order? How soon can we have that?
Your Honor, we could, I assume, have something proposed in the next working week or so.
Okay, so about October 13th?
That range, yes, Your Honor.
All right. Closing remarks by the commissioners. Commissioner Crocius.
Well, I just want to thank everyone for the hard work that they did on this. Staff, the people from Ottertail Power, and it went smoothly from my standpoint. It went very smoothly, but the reason it went very smoothly is because a lot of work occurred before we got to this point. So I really appreciate that. And one thing, and I talked about this a little bit yesterday, I was had the opportunity to address a group at a conference. And as we were going through and asking our questions and for myself personally asking some of the questions, and it's something I brought up yesterday, but there still remains a question in terms of, are we headed in the right direction in terms of resource mix? And I think it's challenging for utilities in particular, because you have to deal with current information rather than future speculation on what regulations may or may not be. So I would still very much like to see a comprehensive energy plan on a national basis to provide more clarity in terms of the direction we are headed, because I don't think we know with certainty that this is exactly what we should be doing. So that's really more of a side note. But again, thank you to everyone for your time and for being here. Appreciate it.
Chairman Christman.
It is on the thanks when we have the information in advance. It's a lot easier to digest in small pieces and understand than sitting here trying to ask questions for 5 or 6 hours trying to understand the project. So thank you both sides for putting it together.
Commissioner Fedorchik.
Also, thanks to everybody for being here and the great information that was exchanged. This project really does illustrate the larger transformation that's occurring in our electric system. And I think that it also shows what happens when you've got regulatory policy that drives things. You've got uncertainty, and you still have a whole lot of innovation that is stimulated by that. And you've got companies who are doing their best to try to come up with the most pragmatic plan in that environment. And so it's important for all of us to continue asking the what-ifs, really tipping over every rock to make sure that we're looking at, you know, all the possible contingencies that could happen and trying to plan for them and make, you know, wise, prudent, cost-effective decisions, but also looking out for the long-term risks and uncertainties of some of these major shifts that are going to be hard to unwind if we get to the point where we need to go a different direction in short order. So I think it's a good plan. I appreciate all the information that you provided to evaluate it effectively, and look forward to, you know, ongoing discussions with Ottertail, and I really appreciate the approach your company takes and just looking at being very frank, open, here's what we're looking at, and really recognizing where we're coming from and some of our needs for the, you know, low cost and need, and putting those front and center. So thanks for all of that. Look forward to getting a decision back as soon as possible on this case.
Okay, thank you, Commissioners. Anything else, Council, to complete the record today? Mr. Stephenson?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Armstrong?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
No, thanks.
Okay, at this point, I'm going to close the hearing on the application of Ottertail Power for a certificate of advanced determination of prudence. For an advanced determination of prudence and a certificate of convenience and necessity, in case numbers PU 17-140, 141, and 143 are closed. And that's it. We're up.